Well, hello, podcast listeners. This is Anne Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. It is no wonder that men are generally very much unsatisfied with the world. Either we are puffed up with pride, racked with desires, dissolved in pleasures, or blasted with cares, and which perfects our unhappiness. We are never alone, but in perpetual conflict and controversy with our lusts. We are startled at all accidents. We boggle at our shadows and fright one another. We boggle at our own shadows and fright one another. That's from Seneca of ancient Rome. I quoted that this morning. It is no wonder that men are generally very unsatisfied with the world. Either we are puffed up with pride, racked with desires, dissolved in pleasures, or blasted with cares, and which perfects our unhappiness. We are never alone, but in perpetual conflict and controversy with our lusts. We are startled at all accidents. We boggle at our own shadows and fright one another. What does it mean to boggle at your shadows? Well, boggle is a word that came up in the context of the verb to shy. What does it mean to shy? Does it mean to boggle? Well, this was a question I was asking myself this morning when I saw the headline in the New York Times. Who's going to tell him Republicans shy from asking Trump to concede? Are you one of the people that thinks that to shy from something means to act shy, to be shy, you know, like timid and retreating? No. To shy is, and I'm quoting the Oxford English Dictionary, to take sudden fright or aversion, to make a difficulty, boggle about doing something, to recoil, shrink. Are there Republicans who are shying from asking Trump to concede? Well, I think whoever wrote the headline must have thought that to shy meant to shrink away, shrink, to recoil, to shrink, meant to be shy about something. But it seems like fright is involved. Shrink, like shrink in horror, that kind of shrink. Pull back. Something is there suddenly and it scares you and you shy. You boggle. I get that. What is this story about? Are there some Republicans who are identified, people who've taken fright and shrunk away from this task? Is there anything like that going on? Who's going to tell him Republicans shy from asking Trump to concede? And I said, I get that Republicans are not telling Trump to concede, but I don't see evidence that they are shying. Who's taking a sudden fright or aversion? Who's recoiling or shrinking? You'd have to establish that there are Republicans who urgently desire to tell Trump to give up and are just freaking out about it. Like a horse spotting a snake, to boggle. That's, what is that word, boggle, that we saw in the Seneca quote that I began with. To boggle is, quote, and I'm quoting the Oxford English Dictionary, to start with fright, to shy as a startled horse, to take alarm, be startled, scared. The article has no one in this position. There's no one who's startled. There's nothing startling going on. In fact, things are dragging out. We're now a week away from the election. It's taking a long time to count things. And Trump isn't ready to concede because it isn't 100% impossible for him to win. There's still a path, a narrow path, but it's there. Why is he required to do something more quickly to help Biden have an easier time of it? No one would give him an easier time. They certainly didn't give him an easy time over the last 4 years. And he actually does have a small chance of winning. So why would any Republican want to tell him he ought to concede? Let him go. Let him do the thing that he's doing. That's what Mitch McConnell talked about yesterday. What is he supposed to do? If the headline is going to be Republicans shy from asking Trump to succeed, there ought to be in the article some evidence that there are some real Republicans who want to do it, who think it is the right advice to give, and they're afraid that there's something intimidating about conveying this information. They could even just say it to the reporters who were eager to get this information. I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing what McConnell said yesterday. I'm seeing four senators who've congratulated Biden. They haven't specifically gone to Trump and tried to get him to do something. They've congratulated Biden. But they're the four who are well established in their antagonism to Trump: Mitt Romney, Ben Sasse, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. They're the closest to being Democrats, I guess, when the Senate is 51-49 and the Republicans still control. Those are the four who the Democrats will need to get to vote with them so they can get a majority. I said, are there even any Trump-allied Republicans who think it's past time for Trump to abandon his fight when the votes are not yet fully counted and litigation routes remain open? Mitch McConnell acknowledged Trump's justification for continuing to question the results. Only four senators have congratulated Biden, but they're the four that are well-established antagonists to Trump. So there's no suddenness, there's no fright, and therefore no shying. Not that I can see from this article. Maybe somewhere in the dark indoor spaces of Washington, Republicans are cowering in fear. But even that has no suddenness to it. There's no shying. I'm going on about this because I am resisting getting drawn into the emotionalism. Shying is an absurdly over-emotional word in that headline. And the appropriate assumption is not that emotions are raging everywhere among the Washington elite. It's that everyone is behaving strategically. The media's calling of the election when it did, the Biden supporters insisting on a concession now, the outrage that questions about voting are raised, the Trump's refusal to give up, the Republicans giving Trump his space to stir up his supporters. It's all cold, hard strategy. That's my assumption. So I'm not I understand why headlines are written in an emotional style, but the idea that there are all these people who are emotional as opposed to simply brutally strategic power seekers, I'm not believing it. I see it as a power struggle. I see people as behaving strategically. They might be mad that they're not getting their way, but it's nothing that we, the people, the humble people, need to worry about. I have a post, goes to show just how wrong you can be. Joy Reid tweeted, here's the thing. The reason there's a thing called 538 is because 538 was the margin in Florida when the Republican SCOTUS reversed the 2000 election during a recount, making W the president. That's the kind of margin where races can flip. That's not what's up now. And Jake Tapper tweeted a response to that. This isn't accurate. The margin in Florida was 537 votes, 538. Where the website name comes from, 538, is the number of Electoral College votes. The SCOTUS didn't reverse the 2000 election. Bush always led in every count. So, goes to show how wrong you can be. I also embedded a copy of the 1966 song, Just Goes to Show How Wrong You Can Be, which was written by P.F. Sloan. Remember P.F. Sloan? P.F. Sloan is a very interesting character. You know, he wrote the Johnny Rivers song, Secret Agent Man. He wrote the Grassroots song, Where Were You When I Needed You. He wrote Eve of Destruction. Yeah, yeah. So P.F. Sloan, remember that? Remember P.F. Sloan? He was like one of the other Dylans of the 60s. But he wrote some good songs. Did you know those songs were all written by the same person? But what I wanted to say here was... There's this effort to say that to distinguish what Gore did from what Bush is from what Trump is doing now, this questioning of the votes and wanting to get a more accurate count, wanting to pursue legal remedies, to say that, well, it was closer when Gore did it. It was closer. It's not as close now. You can make a that is a distinction, that it was closer then. And of course, Gore wanted to look for those extra votes, although he kept litigating even after every single vote was counted. In the current situation, we haven't even counted all the votes yet. Remember when Gore was litigating, Bush's argument was the votes have been counted. They've been counted and recounted. And that's true. Gore kept fighting even after 100% of the votes had been counted and recounted. Whereas now we still haven't counted all the votes. But they're saying that, but the margin is so wide in the various states where maybe it could flip that it's unlikely that it will close. But it depends on what kinds of things Trump might be able to find there or what might be left. I mean, I don't think those votes are going to be found. I'm just not impatient for Trump to give up. I think Trump is entitled to do what he's doing. He's making his choice. If he wanted to give up, that would be fine too. But I'm just not getting caught up in the hysteria about how, oh, he needs to give up. He needs to say, here, I got, speaking of embedded tweets, I've got an embedded tweet from Mick Jagger. As long as I'm talking about 60s music. Mick Jagger spans the many decades, but I see him as mainly a 60s person too. Did you know that Mick Jagger is older than Biden? I think Mick Jagger is 80, isn't he? Someone said that in the comments. Is that true? Is Mick Jagger 80? Maybe I should, let's see, Jagger age. Let's see if this will tell me it very quickly. 77, okay, he's not 80. He's 77, so he's Biden's age. He's quite old. He looks great for his age, and of course he's eternally young. Whatever's up with Mick Jagger, don't really follow him that closely. But somehow I feel like I get what he's doing here. He says, he tweets, I'm so looking forward to coming back to an America free of harsh words and name calling and be amongst people who I know have common ground and harmony. It's a challenge, but it can be done. And I said, this is sarcasm. And I got there via Ed Driscoll at Instapundit, who was criticizing Jagger or mocking Jagger in a way that indicated that he thought Jagger was dead serious when he said that. But I just don't see how that can possibly be true. I'm so looking forward to coming back to an America free of harsh words and name calling. Now, why would Biden getting elected free the country of harsh words and name calling? That's just not going to happen magically. That's silly. I think he's making fun of the hopefulness and the sappiness of the people who are acting like Biden's election is going to bring peace and love. It's just not true. People who I know have common ground and harmony. We may have some common ground, but we've been so divided, and the people who voted for Trump still exist. And it was a very closely balanced election. It was almost even. It was very close to being even. Whatever you say about the popular vote. By the way, you know, I think if a lot of people think because there have been three elections recently where the Democrats have come out millions of votes ahead in the popular vote but lost the Electoral College vote, that means if the Electoral College were eliminated and we relied on a popular vote, that the Democrats would definitely win. That's not so. That I wrote an article back in after the 2000 election in which I went back to books that had been written in the 1960s after the very close 1960 election, and there was an actual active effort to reform the Electoral College one way or another, get rid of the Electoral College. But if you look at some of the details, and I'm not going to elaborate it in great detail, but one thing that would happen would be that you could get third-party candidates. So the Electoral College is working to preserve a two-party system. It's very hard for another party to get in there. So there would be other parties, and they would be getting some of the votes. And you would have to have runoffs. So it would play out very differently. But the fact is that the urban minorities, who seem, you might think, are disadvantaged, they actually have more ability to shift more electoral votes than anyone else. And so they're very valuable votes. And when they make the difference in the election, they shift big states like New York and California tend to always go in the same direction. But what if the conservative candidate could reap millions of votes by going and campaigning in a place in California and New York, those very big states that always just automatically give all their votes to the Democrats, all their electoral votes. Republicans aren't bothering even to try to appeal to those people, let alone campaign to them there. And I think there are lots of votes that could be gathered if they became useful votes. They're not currently useful votes, all those extra people in California that aren't going to make the difference. Anyway, it would all play out very differently, and there would need to be ways of dealing with multiple parties and runoffs. Everything would be different. That's one reason I don't think they're going to change it, because I think the parties know that they're locked in by the Electoral College system. And that if there were just a popular vote, there would be more candidates. How would you winnow them down? How would you do that? How would that play out? And different things would happen. It would be a completely new game, and new ways of playing it would be discovered. It would be quite interesting, and maybe dangerous. Maybe a real. You think Trump is a big populist, but much more extreme forms of populism could catch on and edge out these old parties. Anyway, I think Mick Jagger is joking. I know Mick Jagger didn't like Trump, but that doesn't mean he thinks that the Democratic Party in the United States is the good guys, all the nice people, and if only they're elected, there won't be any fighting. Obviously, even if you love the Democrats and hate the Republicans, the harsh words and name-calling won't go away because they'll still be fighting each other. Why would they be? Why is there this idea of Biden the healer? I don't get that. It doesn't even make sense. It's rather absurd. But, you know, there's this guy, John Meacham, you know, the historian. I wrote about him. Let me find that post. John Meacham, the historian, he wrote that book, American Lion, about Andrew Jackson. Anyway, turns out he has been speechwriting for Joe Biden, and then he was on MSNBC talking about a speech that he himself wrote without revealing that he was that he worked on the speech he was commenting on. So presidential historian John Meacham was speechwriting for Joe Biden and apparently didn't disclose it to MSNBC. And MSNBC has cut him off now as a paid contributor. Meacham worked on Biden's victory speech and then appeared on MSNBC commenting on the speech. MSNBC's Brian Williams asked him, "I'm not the historian that you are, and I don't have the Pulitzer that you do, but do you concur that this is the way we are used to hearing from our presidents?" To which Meacham responded, "Absolutely." So he's being asked, is this the way presidents have spoken in the past, the way Biden is speaking now? And Meacham says, yes. So the implication of that question, as I see it there out of context, is that Trump didn't speak in the conventional presidential way, and Biden is restoring the appropriate tone for the presidency because the historian is able to say, yes, this is the way presidents historically have spoken. This is the presidential way to speak. And of course, Trump didn't speak in the presidential way, although he liked to say, I could speak in that way if I wanted to, but it would be so boring. You'd be completely bored. I could do it, but it would be boring. Anyway, it's pretty awful to go on TV and comment on a speech that you wrote as if you were just hearing it. And here's the New York Times article from yesterday that made the disclosure of Meacham's speechwriting. Helping to shape the words of the president-elect, a presidential historian, John Meacham, best known for writing about past presidents like Andrew Jackson, and George Bush, has helped shape some of Joseph Biden's most significant speeches. Quote, in his victory speech, Mr. Biden spoke of a mission to rebuild the soul of America, to rebuild the backbone of this nation, the middle class, and to make America respected around the world again, and was widely credited with striking the right tone about bringing the country back together. The language echoed the title of Mr. Meacham's 2018 book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, which has long served as a touchstone for Mr. Biden, who reached out to Mr. Meacham in the past to discuss passages he liked. Close quote. And I said, it's very nice for Biden to read a book about America's soul and to want to get some of that high-flown rhetoric into his speeches. But the aspiration toward loftiness is shot to hell if Meacham goes on TV to admire what he's not telling us is his own work. And here's more quoting from the New York Times article. President-elect Joe Biden wrote the speech he delivered to the American people on Saturday night, which laid out his vision for uniting and healing the nation, said T.J. Ducklow, a spokesman for Mr. Biden. Given the significance of the speech, he consulted a number of important and diverse voices as part of the writing process, as he often does. Right, so that just means maybe Meacham wasn't really one of the writers, he was just consulted, and it was Biden who really wrote the speech. Quote, a Biden official said that Mr. Meacham was involved in discussions about the themes in the victory speech. He publicly endorsed Mr. Biden in an op-ed in the Washington Post in March and received a prime speaking spot at the Democratic convention. Mr. Biden's reliance on a historian stands in contrast with President Trump's lack of interest in the past. So never miss an opportunity to take a shot at Trump. He doesn't talk to historians. He's not even interested in the past. But, you know, I want to get into this idea of the soul of America and Biden's theme to rebuild the soul of America and Meacham's book title, The Soul of America. What do you think of the idea that a country has a soul, the soul of America? I like to think that individual human beings have a soul. And when I hear of this composite soul of an entire country, I'm skeptical. I mean, that's what makes me think of fascism. For all the times that Trump has been called a fascist, to me, this soul of America business, when it doesn't sound like just sheer bilge or obvious propaganda, it has a fascistic quality to it, especially if you're not acknowledging the soul of individual people. And so often from the Democratic side, I get the sense that they view their opponents as being soulless, as not having a soul. And I feel that they're also antagonistic to individualism. Everyone needs to think the same thing, and people should be canceled if they don't all say the same thing. So that cancel culture, that suppression of free speech, it seems anti-individualism to me. And so I read that as a rejection of the sense that individual people have a soul. And then you come at this with the idea that America has a soul. There's just an oversoul to America. I know you can go very deeply into that. It reminds me of that speech in The Grapes of Wrath, doesn't it? And I know there's some Emerson stuff you could put there. But I'm not writing a post. I'm doing a podcast. So I can't get into the research and come up with stuff. But if I were reading and writing right now and not talking, and this is the advantage of reading and writing, I would research those things and I would add a few little things. But why don't you go do it? You go read that. I have already given you some Seneca. I've given you some high-flown intellectual stuff. I've been reading to you from the Oxford English Dictionary. How much of that sort of thing do you really want? You hear that sound? That's thunder. We're getting some rain. I'm on the top floor of the house, the part of the house that has no attic above it, aka my closet, and you can hear the rain on the roof. So that's a thing. Let's see. I was also reading this morning Nate Cohn, interviewed in The New Yorker. Nate Cohn explains what the polls got wrong, and I concentrated on one particular part of it. And this is a quote from Nate Cohn, who's the pollster, lead pollster person at The New York Times. But here this is from an interview that's in The New Yorker. Quote, the swing towards Trump in Hispanic areas across the country is extraordinary. It was hinted at in the pre-election polls. The polls showed President Trump faring better among non-white and particularly Hispanic voters than he did 4 years ago. But the magnitude of the ship was way beyond expectations. I think it could easily be a double-digit swing in the president's direction. I've not crunched these numbers conclusively, and it's still too early to do that. But that would be my initial gut sense, yes. The most obvious reason for this, I would assume, is the education divide in our politics manifesting itself across racial lines. And I think this was not an election on immigration. Immigration was a major theme in the 2016 election. So it makes sense to me that if we stop talking immigration and Hispanic voters start assessing President Trump without that in mind, that they might begin to shift in ways that are fairly similar demographically. They might shift in ways that are fairly similar to demographically similar white voters, but 4 years later. So the idea of the kind of classic white working class voter, the Hispanic voters this time around, if you think of the working class white voters in 2016, in 2020, the Hispanic voters were like them, and that it isn't so much about, well, this is like the old observation, it's really more about class than race, and that in that light, Hispanic voters are like the 2016 Trumpsters. And I'm also seeing this today in the Washington Post, why Texas's overwhelmingly Latino Rio Grande Valley turned toward Trump. Excerpt. I guess we say Rio Grande in Texas. Sorry. I know you don't do the Spanish pronunciations when you're in Texas. I learned that from my parents who lived in Texas. And by the way, I was conceived in Texas. Didn't live there, but I feel some connection to Texas because I lived there in utero. Excerpt from the Washington Post article. Quote, and this is a quote from Jason Villalba, president of the Texas Hispanic Policy Foundation. Hispanics have been acculturated in Texas over many generations, and because of that, their perceptions are much more like that of the Anglo population. And University of Texas San Antonio political science scientist Sharon Navarro said the conservatism of some Texas Latinos is nothing new, particularly in rural communities. The difference this year is that Republicans did the work to court these voters and tailor their message about the election around the economy and jobs. Republicans said they are convinced that the margins they won in the Rio Grande Valley and beyond is a sign that the region's politics are trending in their favor. So that's interesting. Let's see, what haven't I gotten to here today? Let's see, the first post of the day was, did I get this yesterday from Jake Tapper? This was a Jake Tapper tweet I embedded yesterday after the podcast. I truly sympathize with those dealing with losing. It's not easy, but at a certain point, one has to think not only about what's best for the nation, peaceful transfer of power, but how any future employers might see your character defined during adversity. Ah, no, I remember reading that yesterday. Yeah, I think I got off on a highly emotional rant, so I'm not going to re-rant, but I think I would say something very similar if I had it to do over again. Now, let's see what we haven't talked about. Well, there is this murder case. 48 years ago, a woman named Jody Loomis was killed, a 20-year-old woman, and the murderer had never been found, but they put Terrence Miller, who is now 78 years old, so he did it, if he did it, 48 years ago, he was 30, Terrence Miller, the 78-year-old man on trial for the murder of 20-year-old Jody Loomis 48 years ago, killed himself on Monday, hours before a jury found him guilty of the heinous crime. Loomis's death, this is a quote from Q13 Fox, Loomis's death went unsolved for 47 years until investigators connected DNA from the crime scene with information that Miller's relatives posted on genealogy websites. He was arrested and charged with murder. in April 2019 and later released on a $1 million bail. So he was out waiting around and was about to go to the jury, and he killed himself. Miller's lawyer tried to have his charges dismissed after learning of his death, but the judge overseeing the case overruled, and the jury returned a guilty verdict Monday afternoon. Guess he didn't want to lose all that work of the jury, but isn't the case moot at that point? The man is dead. There's nothing to do. Nothing to do in that criminal case, anyway. And then I also read the article in the New York Times, which had some additional detail. Semen was recovered from Ms. Loomis's body and from a waffle stomper hiking boot that she'd been wearing at the time and had borrowed from her sister. In 2008, the samples were sent to the Washington State Patrol Crime Laboratory for DNA testing, but they did not return a match. The breakthrough in the case came in 2018 when investigators working with Parabon Nanolabs were able to put together a family tree of possible suspects based on the semen sample found on the heel of the victim's hiking boot. The company uses DNA to help law enforcement agencies find genetic matches. That's when investigators began their surveillance of Mr. Miller, whom they followed to a nearby casino and from whom they retrieved a coffee cup that he had thrown in the garbage, the probable cause affidavit said. The DNA sample was an exact match to the semen found on Ms. Loomis's boot, the affidavit said. He was arrested in 2019 and charged with first-degree murder. Laura Martin, the public defender for Mr. Miller, contested the integrity of the DNA evidence in an email to the New York Times on Monday night. Death seems preferable to letting a jury decide a verdict on tainted evidence, Ms. Martin wrote. This is a terrible tragedy that began with Jody Loomis's death and is compounded by an innocent man taking his own life. When two undercover detectives visited a ceramics business that Mr. Miller ran with his wife out of their garage in November 2018, they noticed a nearly seven-month-old newspaper on a table with a headline about an arrest made in another cold case in Snohomish County, the affidavit said. The case involved a double murder of a young couple from British Columbia in 1987, which led to the conviction of William Talbot II. So it was some evidence, fairly minor evidence, but some evidence that he had kept around, not a new newspaper, but a seven-month-old newspaper that had a story about an arrest in a cold case. And so that showed that maybe he was interested in that. He was worried about that. But this shows how a huge amount of time could have passed since a murder. But if there's still DNA, if the DNA is still there, your DNA is the same. And if your relatives are doing genealogical research using their DNA, making their DNA posted on websites, that can be traced back to you. And all they had to do was follow him in a casino and pick up a cup after he dropped it. Reminds me of that movie Sea of Love. Remember that with, was it Al Pacino, Richard Gere, one of those people? Who am I trying to think of? And then what's her name? Can't remember. I can remember scenes in a restaurant where the female detective was trying to get a sample from everyone, and they needed him to drink from, once she had the glass, she had what she needed, but she was pretending to date him. And then went with the one character, he never drinks from the glass. He gets suspicious and leaves, and he's never touched anything. So she doesn't have his DNA. Remember that movie, Sea of Love? Anyway, let's see. There was an article that I found pretty amusing about people who go away from home because they have to work from home, then they go somewhere, they travel somewhere to work in an exotic place. So this article is called, it's in the New York Times, called "The Digital Nomads Did Not Prepare for This. They moved to exotic locales to work through the pandemic in style, but now tax trouble, breakups, and COVID guilt are setting in." And I, and this is very amusingly written article by Aaron Griffin. And here's the quote that I pulled out. Quote, if you're going to work from home indefinitely, why not make a new home in an exotic place? It turns out there are drawbacks. Sorry about all the rain. It turns out there are drawbacks to the trend stories and Instagram posts didn't share. Text things, red tape things, Wi-Fi rage things, closed border things, the kinds of things one might gloss over when making an emotional quarantine-addled decision to pack up an apartment and book a one-way ticket to Panama or Montreal or Kathmandu. The anxious self-optimization ping-pongs between why aren't I living my best life and why aren't I killing it at work? You know, this is just me adding, some of these people would go to some resort, but then there wasn't that much to do because restaurants and so forth were closed and, you know, they could swim in the pool and tan or whatever. Work out in the gym, but after a while you start to think, this isn't good enough. Why did I come all this way? And also, am I doing a very good job at my work? Why aren't I killing it at work? And I liked, I ended it with this little anecdote. Ms. Smith Adair's office became a folding chair on the sidewalk outside whatever McDonald's or Starbucks was nearby. It wasn't exactly a peaceful commune with the Redwoods. During one curbside conference call in Eugene, Oregon, a nearby man with a weed whacker began roaring his motor. Ms. Adair Smith told him she was trying to salvage her career. He didn't care. Close quote. And I said, there's a photo with the wonderful caption. Quote, after 6 months in Costa Rica, Austin Mao, M-A-O, Austin Mao returned to the United States, where he has fewer opportunities to chop open coconuts knocked out of trees by monkeys. And I said, that's like the first line of a novel. And I love the main character's name, Austin Mao. There's also the story of a guy stranded in Portugal. There's also the story of a guy stranded in Portugal with his visa expired who attempts to apply for asylum there. Quote, I said, Trump's a dictator. My city is burning and people are dying. They made a joke that I was the first person since the Vietnam War from America to ask for that, close quote. The Portuguese officials were nice anyway. They laughed at him but extended his visa. Strangely, in the comments over there, people are bitching about it. Why did the New York Times even publish it? They regret reading. Oh, I see what's going on. One commenter says, are we supposed to feel sorry for these people who made selfish, ill-advised decisions? And I said, unlike these Portuguese officials, they don't know how to laugh. Notice having to ask, am I supposed to feel sorry for these people? No. You're supposed to laugh at them. You're allowed to laugh. This gets my tag. Era of that's not funny. This is the era of that's not funny. A lot of people have forgotten how to laugh. Now you could say, oh, but people are dying. There's a disease and Trump was president. So how can you laugh? No, that's when you need to laugh. The worse things are, the more you have to keep the laugh dimension of your existence alive. Keep that alive. Keep that part of you alive. Now let's see. What haven't I talked about? Is the only thing left this bit about Adrienne Rich? Possibly. I was reading a New York Times book review. There's a new biography of the poet Adrienne Rich, and the New York Times book reviewer is Dwight Garner. And you know I have a thing about the word Garner, but it doesn't apply when Garner is just somebody's name. It's Jennifer Garner, James Garner, Dwight Garner. Garner is fine as a name. I just have a problem with Garner as a verb. You know how I feel about verbs. I've already talked today about the verb shy, so I won't get into my Garner thing. It's fine that a man is named Dwight Garner. I'm not complaining about his name, but he does begin his book review, his review of this biography of Adrienne Rich, by telling us long before I read her, I disliked Adrienne Rich. She was a radical lesbian separatist who didn't want men at her readings and would not respond to their questions. A humorless scold. perceived to have bent her sensitive talent on a political wheel. Garner also complains that the biography makes it difficult for anyone to criticize Rich's work for any reason whatsoever and not be thought complicit in the grinding machinery of misogyny. Well, I don't know about all that, obviously. I, unlike Garner, have not read the biography. I don't know if the author does make it difficult to criticize Rich's work. Obviously, the author admires Rich, so doesn't leave a lot of openings for criticizing her. But so what if it's difficult? Do some hard work, Dwight Garner. Criticize her if you want. Apparently, you succeeded in doing it in this review, so how difficult could it have been? And also, what's wrong with having to do what is difficult? Don't whine. But I blogged about it because I wanted to quote things that can only be hinted at in a short review of the new biography of the poet Adrian Rich. Quote, how Louise Gluck, the new Nobel laureate, was no admirer of Rich's teaching practices at Columbia University when Gluck was a student there. Rich's remarks on her students' poems were often limited to a comment like, I don't dig it. And another thing is how Anthony Burgess sublet Rich's New York apartment, tore it up, and then wrote a novel that satirized its feminist contents. And I said, I just want to know what Anthony Burgess did, what the feminist contents were, and how he satirized them. I give you a link to the biography, and I went to page 242 and quote it. Burgess cut a tornado's path of destruction through her home, a mattress missing, a box spring ripped, bedroom tables dotted with cigarette burns, kitchen utensils missing, burned, or broken, a lamp broken, and a sofa and rug stained with spilled food. Close quote. Rich sought reimbursement, and Burgess said his $475 security deposit ought to cover the petty damage, especially since he'd gotten the apartment wired for cable TV. And I looked it up, and the misogynistic novel was Clockwork Testament or Enderby's End. That's a 1974 book by Anthony Burgess, who also wrote Clockwork Orange, but this is Clockwork Testament. And Enderby is a character who more or less is Burgess. He's staying in the apartment of a humorless, man-hating novelist, and that's basically Rich, who, quote, whose bookshelves bulge with treatises on race, gender, and revolution that Enderby views with distaste, close quote. And those quotes are from the new bio, so they don't convey any spirit of satire. I would have bought the Kindle version of the Clockwork Testament and gotten some quotes directly from Anthony Burgess, and that might have been very interesting, but there was no Kindle version of Enderby's End. So, otherwise known as the Clockwork Testament. So maybe that gets us to the end of all the many things we wanted to talk about today. I haven't blogged about Mike Pompeo's recent statement. I guess I could talk about that, but that is another, if you're wondering why don't you talk about that, I haven't blogged about it yet. I don't have a blog post to play off of, but if I were, but I do know the I do know the video, the quote from Pompeo that you might be looking at, and I won't try to quote it off the top of my head because I'm not seeing it immediately as I try to... Oh, here it is. Pompeo on election results. There will be a smooth transition to a Trump administration, because someone asked him if there would be a smooth transition to the... to the Biden administration. So he joked by coming back and saying there'll be a smooth transition to the second Trump administration. This is the thing about emotionalism. It's, and also lack of a sense of humor. Arab, that's not funny. It's nothing to get emotional about. He's just saying the same thing we've been hearing from Trump and from McConnell and so on, that they're going to continue to look into the votes and they're not conceding yet. And so if a news reporter wants to say, how do we know this won't interfere with a smooth transition to the Biden administration? Pompeo's rejoinder is just there'll be a smooth transition to the second Trump administration. And it's just, I think it's just pushback against the reporter talking about the Biden administration as if it was a 100% sure thing when it's only a 99 point whatever thing. and Pompeo was making a joke. You can see the smile on his face, but everybody has to get all exercised and dramatic about everything. And nobody knows how to take a joke. Now, maybe you shouldn't joke when you're talking about that much power and you're a wielder of power. It's not fair to do that to other people. It's the punching down problem in humor. But still, even if you don't like a joke, and I think this is a very important thing about humor, it's important to recognize when someone is doing humor, just so you can understand what they're saying. Even if you think the joke is in poor taste, or the joke is too cruel, or the joke isn't funny enough, just in trying to understand the state of mind of the words that are being said, the state of mind behind the words that came out of somebody's mouth, to understand that they meant it as humor is important to understanding it, quite aside from whether it's a joke, right? It's the same with the sarcasm in Mick Jagger. If it's sarcasm, the thing he's saying is the opposite of what he thinks. I'm sure America will get together and find harmony. I'm sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. It's not the greatest level of humor, but it's a mistake not to be able to see it as humor. That's not the same as finding it funny or thinking, yeah, I wish I could come out with clever remarks like that. Try to find what's actually funny, you know. And if you don't like the jokes that Mick Jagger and Mike Pompeo are cranking out, crank out some of your own jokes. Let's have some good jokes. Don't forget about humor. Don't become so embroiled in all the negativity and drama that nothing will ever be funny again. It's all just so, so sad.